Alright, I'm sitting with Ross Harley at ICEA and to discuss some topics about media art in Australia. But first of all, to sort of get a brief history of Ross's involvement with media art education, we want to ask a first question, which is, what was your first engagement with actually teaching media art?
Well, I think I should also say, Paul, that we're sitting here in the Belfast Conference Centre, and that it's the what's the date today? It's
28th.
The 28th. So it's the 28th of August, 2009, because I think that's very important information for you to have. So it's probably about 20 years ago, 1989, I first started teaching in the School of Film and Theatre, as I think it was called then, at the University of New South Wales. And I was employed as a half-time tutor to teach video production, basically, and experimental film, avant-garde cinema, and the like. So, in those days...
Can you give me a... you've already given me a date.
Yeah, so 1989 was when I first started teaching those sorts of courses. And so the courses that I was responsible for were the avant-garde cinema classes and the video, what was called a video production exercise, or something like that. It might have had another name then. And basically, instead of using film, we started to teach students how to make experimental cinema, but using video techniques. So my background had got me started in film and photography and video from my undergraduate days. So so I started working with 3/4-inch U-matic cameras and porta packs, which were not so portable, but they called them porta packs. But they're like huge, heavy kind of bags that were cabled to large cameras.
So was the course that you were doing then, when you said you started to teach using video, was this a self-directed development into this? So did you have to write a kind of different curriculum to...
Yeah, well, back in those days, equipment and the means of production was certainly becoming more available, but in institutions there wasn't much gear. And so throughout the 80s and 90s, one of the cries of artists and practitioners was, we need access to gear in order to make work, and especially as, video art, which was sort of, for me, that was like an emerging discipline. So in terms of teaching this course, I had to figure out a way to teach. I think we probably had 30 to 40 students. And we probably had one or two cameras, right, and one editing suite. And the editing suite was, I think, the school had bought a VHS, like a Panasonic VHS editing suite, which would allow you to do assemble editing and insert editing, and it had its own room in one of these demountable huts. So the classes sort of had to be organised around the lack of availability of equipment.
Would you say that, to some extent, the lack of availability of equipment generated a kind of totally different approach to structuring and teaching the course?
It meant that basically we had to, we sort of had a division of... assessment tasks, which would be individual in terms of pre-production and script development and writing, storyboarding, that all students could engage in because, the tools of pen and paper and you know, concept development were easily available. But then students would then have to work in teams of groups, and then we would have to schedule the availability of, you know, the equipment pool, which was one or two cameras, right? And likewise, time in the editing rooms, which would be, I think that during that stage, we were basically, you know, we'd give students time in the, you know, the editing suite to cut things together.
Is there any, two questions really in one. The references that you were using to demonstrate to students other video artwork that you were aspiring to, and whether there was any theory developing around video art at that time within the curriculum.
Yeah, my background really had me connected to European experimental film and cinema, political cinema, particularly of Jean-Luc Godard and Straub, and European kind of political experimental filmmakers who were starting to move into video. So Godard had done a lot of work between cinema and video in the 70s and 80s, and so that was, like, if you like, a kind of core text, core reference. So so around that time, that was around the time of Sauve qui peut, and Every Man for Himself, and Hail Mary sort of came out a little later. And those works all were experimenting with different techniques of video production in order to intervene into narrative filmmaking. So Godard, of course, was always
references that you're using? I mean, who was on the scene at that time? Was there anybody?
Yeah, then there were, I suppose, a number of kind of reference points. There was the Sydney Filmmakers Co-op, which at that time was probably, you know, it's probably entering the end of its sort of, more powerful and kind of more influential period from in the earlier 1980s. So it was really an 80s organization. But the Filmmakers Co-op distributed a whole lot of experimental and kind of agitprop political cinema, and they started moving into video in the later 1980s.
Can I ask?
And so we would use a lot of those sorts of works. And there were also works that were in the National Lending Collection of the National Film Library. So we would order films. We used to have to order the films, well in advance.
Yes.
And then they would arrive, these, you know, the big reels. And then you'd show the films, all the videos, if there were some. They'd arrive and then you'd show them and then you'd have to ship them back. And it was a whole kind of arcane process.
If you were to, let's say, suggest that video art started to maybe come into the art schools around the late 70s or late 80s, I mean early 80s.
Yeah, it was late 70s, early 80s, really.
With the first Porter Packs coming in. I mean, 60, when was 65 was the first Porter Pack that was made. So, but what I would like to ask is the meteoric rise of video art to its demise, does it parallel a kind of media arts? Because video art actually, there was curators of video art and stuff, and then suddenly it all fell away when it became digitized. I don't know whether it digitizes, but it fell away.
I would have two responses. On the one hand, I would say yes, by the early 2000s, video art kind of ceases to exist as a kind of a category that people are willing to use. But at the same time, it's precisely that moment when artists start to use video as an everyday medium. So it's the kind of the beginning and the end of video art is around about 2001, is what I would argue. And that's certainly what John Gillies and I argue in this ARC project that we're doing on Sydney video art. And the different organisations and the collectives, because of course there were there was also the the Super 8 film group and people who are making, you know, experimental or kind of playful works in that group. And that had an influence on the sort of things that we would teach as well.
What I was getting at in relationship to that was that if you plotted the kind of interactive media arts as a
category.
Well, as a developing genre that needed to grow out of something, then obviously it grew out of video art and performance to some extent.
Yep.
You also had sound art as another medium that was, you know, introduced into art schools about 75.
Yep.
I mean, it would have been, but in a kind of curriculum sense, it was introduced. So you have these two almost examples. So if we were to now jump to, let's say, more contemporary understanding of our curriculum development or our educational development, you've got these two separate almost categories like video art, sound art.
Yeah.
You know, and now this is blown out of the water to, you know, from bio arts to chem arts to, we could go on.
I mean, I think as soon as you start to put a kind of a technology, you know, a technological medium in front of the word art, then that's when you start to get into all of these kinds of problems. So, you know.
But let's just say that we could discuss this as a development area. My point would be that would you see in developing curriculum for video art in that time, and now having to then be responsible for a whole course where you develop curriculum, the rapid rate of growth of these add-ons has formulated a huge problem of how you can actually...
Well, I mean, for me personally, I always had problems with those categories, and so one of the reasons why I was interested in the work of people like Goddard, and then at the same time, you know, popular culture and, you know, music video and MTV and, you know, you know, post-punk pop.
And Severed Heads, Peter Callis?
Yeah. I mean, Severed Heads and Peter Callis sort of around about at the same time. But it's more, I suppose I was more influenced and more kind of interested in and aligned to the work of people like Philip Brophy and in Melbourne. Yeah, because they too were sort of not, I mean, in a sense, many of us didn't care about video art as a category. We cared about making stuff that maybe you could call art or not, but so engaging with, you know, image and sound, because the video medium was really just a way to marry sound, image, text together. So that's what I was interested in. And so a lot of what I was teaching was, I never really taught video art because I didn't really believe in that category, even though that's what I then, you know, became known as in the department. People would say, well, you know, Ross is the video artist, you know, and that was an odd, you know, an odd position to have, because this is the other point to make, is that that teaching, like where I was teaching, was sort of in the wrong spot. So everyone has this experience of trying to figure out where these sorts of courses should be taught. So it raises the whole question of disciplinarity.
Yeah.
So I wasn't in an art school.
But that would be my last sort of question. Would be the sort of culmination of this with all these different subjects is, where does the art school actually exist now?
Yeah.
Within that structure, and is the traditional notion of the art school a lost cause to some extent?
Well, I mean, the art school, you know, will continue to exist within the university structure, and so therefore it has to work within the disciplinary domains that are basically determined, you know, outside of its own ability to, you know, to make up disciplines. So all of this is now coded, you know, nationally and, you know, to some extent internationally. We fit into these categories, but the disciplinary question is really, really interesting around art and media and design, because it doesn't necessarily all fall into the art school's domain. So,
I mean, a lot of the courses that you're talking about didn't, the video art didn't, I'm presuming, didn't come out of an art school originally.
Yes and no. There were some coming out of the art schools, but my own personal experience was
through another direction.
Yeah, it's coming. Yeah, it's coming out of you know, in the humanities and performing arts.
I mean, one of the interesting things for me about video art in the early days was its relationship to performance art and the mismatch of the two. In other words, the person who took the video of the performance art became a video artist by default.
That's right.
You had these strange categories sort of emerging. And so I was interested in, again, how this interest that you had in video art, how it shaped the curriculum on a personal
I mean, the other thing that I then did, so after, so I sort of taught this course, well, I had responsibility of it until I left that department, and the school morphed, you know, two or three times. In fact, I did change. I moved in, and the school became the school of theatre. It was, first of all, it was theatre studies, and then it became the school of theatre and film, just when I arrived, I think. Then it became the school of theatre, film and dance. And then I moved into another school, the School of Media and Communications. I forget, I'd have to check what year that was, probably around 2000 or something. But so in the 1990s, I started to develop courses which were sort of interdisciplinary but had a lot of different arts coming into them, so electronic arts basically. So I did. I remember I had one course which was called Global Grooves. It was like kind of a funny name, but it was basically so after the Nam June Paik piece, which is really thinking about you know, questions of globalization, you know, electronic forms of communication, robotics, you know, electronic music. So I sort of pushed all of that into this course,
which is a theory.
Yeah, which was, so this was a theory, history, and kind of a watching, listening, and then thinking course, which the students could also, they could do their response either as like an essay, or they might make a work if they were capable of doing that.
These are the kind of things that course that you're now talking about, are some of the interesting things that actually shape the kind of future of how students engage and then develop.
Yeah.
The question that arises, I suppose, is the broadness of the interdisciplinarity, whereas certain traditional mediums within art have, again, as you said, a registered set of material tools to some extent that categorize them, whereas media art hasn't developed that set of tools. It's almost more conceptual and more theoretical. And do you see that as being its major?
I think there are two lines. So one line, which sort of goes along the, you know, the digital media line, is to actually create these new disciplines, but in the digital mode. So it's like, you know, digital video or digital audio, digital photography. You know, so just again by putting digital in front, that descriptor then seems to create this whole new category, and often when you do that, you sort of fall into a sort of technological determinist position, where it's the, you know, it's the software, it's the technology which determines the work, rather than the other way around, where you think about creating work and then you determine what tools are available to make that work, which I think is more interesting. But the curriculum.
But with what you just said then, how could you map that into an institution? Because institutions don't seem to be able to structure that kind of, where you have these burgeoning ideas, and the ideas then attracted to materials, which could mean materials anywhere across the university or across what we actually know. Then how do you allow students that flexibility?
That's what's really hard, because, you know, just getting students to understand their own degree is hard enough. Getting them to be able to move across degree boundaries or disciplinary boundaries is really difficult, unless you program for that in the very structure of the degree. So, you know, ideally I would love for our degrees now, and for, you know, all of the degrees that I've been involved in, to have components that come from other disciplines. So these days, you know, I would say I want to have you know, interdisciplinary connections with computer science and engineering, faculty of built environment, architecture and design, as well as the humanities and the art school. So in my particular institutional context, that's four different faculties. So when you have a program that tries to give students the flexibility to be able to take courses across those different faculty, it becomes really quite complex. And so, not that that's impossible. And then the second issue is to do with just, you know, the way in which we teach, you know. So as practitioners, like those of us who teach in the studio, in the media arts field, I mean, if we're teaching a course where students have to make something, often we feel most comfortable when we've also got the technical expertise with the tools set, right? So, you know, if we're working in video, you want to know the video system, you know, is it like the mini DV system, say, with the FireWire, and then with the computer systems and the software that you're using, and then once you go down that path, then you tend to start to frame your courses around like the how to, you know, put the tape in the camera, the how to, you know, set up your lights.
But the problem with that, which we've come across in the media arts, is that what you told them to do in first year has become redundant in the second year because, you know, there's no longer a firewire cable because it's just a hard drive and, you know, it's no longer time-based, it's no longer on tape, it's just a file. And the whole and when students come into that, they have no awareness that only 2 years ago that...
No.
Like 16 years ago, there was the internet wasn't, you know, now...
But what you've hit upon is, again, like there's a difference between the student kind of experience or the student kind of expectations or the student knowledge that is brought to bear, right? And so they come in with a whole set of things that they know or don't know. And that's one kind of framing device. The other framing device is the teacher, right? Or the teachers who do have that longer history that you're referring to. And often they, you know, they say, well, no, we know that there's HD video and that's the latest thing, but we're not going to teach you that because we're going to use standard definition, we're going to use the 4:3 format, and we're just going to use, you know, stereo files. And in fact, we prefer you to work in mono because, you know, it gives you blah, blah,
limited
blah. It's a limited palette type of thing. And so the students say, oh, but can't we use HD or, you know, I want to do something in 5.1. Yeah. You say, well, no, because you can do that later on in second year or third year.
But, you know, in that kind of but ideology, still, you know, you could go back further and say, well, we're going to do it in, you know, we've got an old porter pack. You know? So, it's like, where do we draw these lines of technological advancement? Is it, you see, within going back to the painting again, you know, they would be teaching a similar colour theory that they would have taught. Once we got with the Commodore, the millions of colours, and then we got the billions of colours, you know, and the colours are neutral. Let's say they're not hierarchical necessarily within digital. So we've got this whole different structure, and the theoretical structure of that.
Yeah.
And this is evolving so rapidly. So,
John, welcome, please take us to the registration desk. That's John, welcome to the registration desk. Thank you.
It's how do we separate these points of saying, well, we're not going below that point again, and then we're going on to the next.
So again, it's really hard. I think there are two things that happen. A lot of it is driven by just the economics of your departments, right?
Or the individual knowledge within the department.
Yeah. So, I mean, There was a moment when, you know, computers really started to come into the equation in the, it's really like the early 90s is when that really starts to happen. Like you have to get, you know,
access to computers,
and so therefore you need the money, you need to buy them, and then you're into this whole kind of cycle of software updating
and then
the machines.
You've got leases coming into universities. You've got art schools having fairly cheap computers to company.
Becomes cheaper.
To kit out a computer lab in 1980, 1998, to like 40,000.
So the price drops, but it's still, I mean, it's a significant, you know, cash Well, it's a significant kind of financial outlay. Yeah, it's an investment. But then there's also there's the anxiety of the new, right? So some teachers say, I don't want to, you know, move forward anymore, and I'm just going to teach, you know, large format photography, which is what you need to know, and like forget all this digital stuff. And you might be able to say that 1 year, but then the next year you can't say that.
That's my whole point about the sustainability of traditional mediums within, like, you can see that quite clearly with large format photography, and like the amount of wet dark rooms that are being lost to the digital, and so on. And then there's a nostalgia for the process for a while, but universities aren't going to pay that bill.
Yeah, but analog photography is actually an interesting kind of case in point. So, and I would say, I would actually make a sort of slightly different argument there, and I would say one of the things that will distinguish universities from, you know, everywhere else, so that is your you know, your home computer and like your own kind of, you know, Nikon D90 camera or whatever it is that you have, what the art school can provide is something which is the equivalent of, like, you know, a screen print workshop, or like it's the heritage media. So the dark room becomes an essential part of heritage media, which is very important to keep and preserve.
I would suppose I would see it much more coming from your initial thing of a conceptual development, that once you start talking about lens-based media, let's say, then it seems appropriate to go back to dichromates and so on.
Yeah, that's right.
And so that then the student starts to evolve into that, rather than all the equipment's laid on and kept in a kind of posterity where there's this great romantic nostalgia for it, where it's initiated based on demand. Because if we're going to say that we're going to privilege these mediums over other mediums, why is art schools privileging these mediums when they could be privileging these other mediums alongside? So how are they developing this? And with media art, like the computer being an art school within an art school, to some extent, a student can do painting, sculpture, printmaking all through the computer as well as...
Yeah, but mostly they don't. Well, you know, certainly in my experience, that, I mean, one of the things that I would like to see more of is exactly that. I would like to see painting taught using computers. I would like to see sculpting, you know, sculpture 101 should be like, you know, how do you do CAD and kind of rapid prototyping, say? I'm exaggerating here, but you know.
How do you wire up Arduino boards?
That's right, yeah. So how do you do physical computing? That could be part of sculpture, that could be part of, you know, these other
toolkit that you might need.
So
then we're getting back to this thing about.
But again, but people in those disciplines, right? You know, so the discipline heads, if you like, who have got their own training and their own view of the world. You know, often they would say, you know what? If you're coming into ceramics, there's all, you know, you have to start with, you know, clay, and you have to start by, you know, making a pot and doing pinch pots or whatever, or knowing how to throw a wheel or whatever. And it's the same in other media as well.
But with the media that we're working with, and I know that there are advances in ceramics and there are advances in materials. A lot of ceramics, well, some ceramics, is starting to become linked much more with design for industry courses now to be either saved or the materiality of that process. With our development of media art, do you think that we, in being this evolution, in not defining it as a sector, that media art now can't defend itself or can't position itself within the university structure as saying it is this, and this is what we need to fund, and this is what we need more development curriculum in, because there's no curriculum development being done in this area. It's very much based on the individual lecturer's personal, interest that these courses, and if we see that as a rhizomatic tree growing from 75, let's say, up, then that, where does that fit within the structure of the...
Well, I mean, the other important thing to think about in the educational context is the relationship to secondary education, which is really important. So media arts basically hasn't found its way into the secondary curriculum in a formal, structured way, which makes requirements upon universities as far as teaching and so on is concerned. So that's one side of the equation. The other side of the equation is the relationship to industry that we have, or you know, the purported relationship to industry. So you know, so industry wants its you know, employees who are, you know, recent graduates from universities to be you know, skilled and knowledgeable in the latest, you know, up to the minute.
Which we could argue is almost an impossibility because of the rapid speed.
It is. So
I mean
one of the
things. Staff can't keep up, and that's what they're paid
to. No, and when, so once you finish your training in any field, but particularly in our field, then when you get a job in that area, often you work with tools that you've never worked with before. So you need to be able to understand, you know, the concepts of, say, let's say 3D, you know, how does light work, how do forms work, and there might be different pieces of software.
This then starts to suggest a different kind of structure to the education, because you're talking about the kind of the elements, let's say, as being the teaching sort of the fabric of the teaching. In other words, you talk about light as a construct, and then rather than
That's
talk
right.
about specific media and so
yeah,
on,
yeah, like exactly.
You go through.
So yeah, so if you talk, so if
so
if instead of
way, this could be a way of
right.
Evolving a kind of a different curriculum basis then.
Yeah, because then, so that's going back to the start of our conversation about, you know, the disciplinary nature of our courses and majors. So, you know, if you major in video or in sound, it's as if, you know, all you're going to be doing is working with Pro Tools, right? But of course, that's crazy. I mean, that's not what you do at all. And the best sound people do a whole range of other things. So you could think of, instead of organizing curricula around, you know, audio, video, you know, interactivity, photography, you know, 3D, let's say, you could organize things around, you know, questions of time, questions of, you know, light, the effects of light.
Well, the questions of atmosphere, the questions of, you know, I mean, all these things are the vehicles by which sound is transported, and therefore. But maybe we should think about wrapping it up, because we're in a. But in the final session, there's still the fundamentals of shaping a future. Now, interestingly, you know, where your work and at COFA and also Wollongong University are both designing new art schools.
Yep. Yeah, it's crucial.
Yeah, and therefore you're at a pivotal point in time where you're one of the people that's going to direct, because COFA has a fairly prominent place in this area of study, and its history through Alexander Mackey, through City Art Institute, now it is one of the leaders. It's maybe within the relationship with the Australia Council, formed a strong relationship with academics being funded by the Australia Council, not as academics but as artists,
mm-hmm.
and still using the resources that they're developing within that. So you have this flow on to curriculum all the time. I'm just interested if you could institutionally map some of those elemental ideas within the institution now, or is it the institutions, you know, the problem?
I mean, institutions are incredibly problematic because there are so many requirements.
What we're trying to do here is say that if we had evidence that media art had done A, B, and C, and it had been successful in certain things and been totally unsuccessful, but the rhizomatic process of this growth of an area that never formed itself into an area alongside the traditional areas that was at the time saying it was at the cutting edge of emerging technologies.
That's always been the discourse, hasn't it?
Yeah.
Of the new.
But it seems to have lost that momentum. It lost that energy. And so if being the head of school, I come to you and say, I want to implement a new media art course, you'd say, well, where's the general proof, business plan, structure that you're going to put to implement this, and where's the need in the public?
Yep. For it?
So where would these, I mean, this is a too big a question, but...
It's a big question to end up on, Paul. But basically it's through, I do think we need to rethink the curriculum, and this is a whole other conversation, but I think that there are many things that you could do in terms of the way in which you think about the use of time, the use of different spaces, the way in which we organize the resources that we make available, the way in which we recognize the technical infrastructure that we provide and how that connects to the things that students bring with them, you know.
I suppose I'd go a little bit
like
further,
laptops, yeah, and
I would go further in the sense of also location, regionality,
mm-hmm.
you know, the notion of a national
yep.
Way of thinking about this rather
yep.
than a state-based thinking
yep.
as this.
Well, I suppose I think more internationally is so.
Well, I think that first of all, you know, like to go internationally, we first of all have to define what it is we're going internationally with, and I think we need to do some homework in that area.
Well, it's more, I suppose. Well, I would connect it more to what we know is the case internationally with media arts and its evolution.
Well, I think that, you know, in looking at Catherine Mason's book yep. and other things, that you would see that there's a lot of interest in this area now, but a lot of it has grown. As I said, rhizomatically through this
yeah.
process. So it's like saying, well, maybe this is something that should be endorsed
mm-hmm.
as a potential interesting model, as opposed to the rather than
mm-hmm. yep.
you know, the discipline
yep.
models.
Yep.
You've got this rhizomatic model
yep.
that allows for connectivities to be made much
yeah.
more than a sort of synaptic.
What that would mean is that you'd have to have. Then you need some kind of structure, like so local, national, and international structure
and
for that discussion.
And how could curriculum, would curriculum exist only for the moment
yeah.
that it was written and then as it
yeah.
grew out of it?
So but again, like I mean, if you sat down and did a workshop around all of these things, I could imagine how you could do exactly that. So let's say, you know, at the national level, we decided that we share a whole lot of resources, but many of us do different versions of the same thing often, and sometimes those things might be, might be resourced in a shared, collaborative kind of model where just, you know, very, very simple kind of level of, you know, the design of courses or the materials and the manual instruction of, you know, how to do things, you know, step by steps for, you know, some of the technical but also the conceptual frameworks.
They're hand in hand, but with the contemporary art student coming into a situation where the potential is for them to be frozen, let's say, within all 25 of the students doing a Final Cut Pro tutorial, or saying, well, we've got QuickTime, we've got iMovie, we've got Final Cut Pro, we've got Motion, we've got, you know,
yep.
or if we go down the Adobe Premiere thing,
yep.
but all these different things, but then we've got the silly little, you know, take lots of little photographs, and I've got my mobile phone,
yep.
And then it starts to grow out to all
yeah.
these other, and you, so do you say, right, we're going to limit you, or we're going to say, here's the capabilities,
yeah.
and I'm going to expose you to the capabilities, but I'm not going to teach you the thing because...
Yeah, again, that's so, like, certainly in our institution, that's a complete institutional turnaround, a complete institutional change. So, therefore, teachers have to teach in a different way. Therefore, the software has to be supported in a different way. The IT services, the way in which you arrange the rooms, but, like, sure.
So I have one student that wants to do Photoshop, but do just a slight animation, and anyway, well, that's me done. We'll wrap it up now. Thanks very much, Ross Harley.
We can continue it some other time, Paul.